Wieland Presley and Van Hull Funeral Homes have been serving Quad City families and veterans for over 100 years. Wieland Presley is located in Rock Island, Milan, Reynolds, and Van Hull in East Moline, proudly supporting WQPT.
Trying to better serve those with disabilities and telling the story of the venerable Wharton Fieldhouse in the cities. In a few days, WQPT will bring to you a documentary about a building that's far more than bricks and mortar. Wharton Fieldhouse has been an important part of the fabric of the cities since the Roaring Twenties, almost 100 years ago. More on that in a moment. But first, the effort to better serve those in the Quad Cities with disabilities. It's been 6 months since the Handicap Development Center changed its name to Empowering Abilities. But it's been more than just a renaming of letterheads and buildings. Carol Foster is the Chief Administration Officer. So it's been about 6 months since the name change. Why was it so critically important? Because this is more than changing your letterhead or the sign. This really is underlining what you do.
There were a lot of sign changes and a lot of letterhead changes and all kinds of things.
Don't take that for granted.
Yeah, and we're starting to see some of that still crop up. It'll be a while. But, you know, this has been a long process. Part of it is that we talked about it for many years, and it was just kind of overwhelming. And those of us who have been around for a long time, I've been there for a long time, it was kind of an emotional thing because we were connected to that old name. But as we did some of the research, we talked to all of our constituents. We talked to our family members. We talked to the community at large, our supporters, our donors, the individuals that we serve. They pretty much, to a person, said something needs to change because it didn't really describe what we do anymore. Handicapped was something that a lot of the participants that we served didn't feel comfortable with. In fact, they often didn't say that. They would just say HDC. They'd shorten it because they didn't feel comfortable using that word. And the word center really didn't describe what we did either. When we first started our programs, everybody kind of went to the same spot and they were all doing their own thing right there in that same area. Now our whole emphasis is getting people out in the community and integrating them into the community. So it really didn't describe what we do. So we did a lot of research. We had people help us get through that process. And finally landed on Empowering Abilities. And I think we are so excited about that. And the participants are super excited about it too. You should have seen when we unveiled it to them. There was a huge roar of acceptance and approval. They were so excited about it.
And that was back last Thanksgiving during that period of time.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it is a huge deal. But take me back, and I know you weren't there at the beginning, but HDC, which is what I'll use, started 55 years ago this year.
Right.
I mean, the landscape for people with disabilities, as well as people who interact with disabilities, has dramatically changed in, what would that be, almost three generations.
Right. And we don't want to forget the people that helped us start out. I mean, the families worked really hard to get those services because they weren't available around here at that time. Families, the participants, the staff, all the people that came through the doors. We don't want to forget about that because we want to honor all of that hard work. But honestly, it has changed. We have people that have been around for a long time that kind of grew up in institutions because there wasn't really anything available for families. And the families really had no other options. But when these kind of services started coming up, it was such a great relief that they could bring their families back home to their home communities. And so it's been wonderful to see all of that progress, but we still have a little bit of a ways to go. Even for folks that have talked about how they went to regular schools, sometimes they didn't always have the greatest experience.
Sure.
But part of our job now is to help people have the community accept them. We can show them that they can work in the grocery stores and help bag your groceries. They might take your ticket at a movie theater. They might go to the same parks and museums and all those kinds of things, and we help them do that. And so you really see that there's a lot of progress that has been made, but we still have some things we can work on.
You do have about 350 clients. Is that the right word to use?
We call them participants.
That are served through the organization. There's always the belief that that's just touching the tip of the iceberg, that more resources are needed. Is that the case, or is the need being met?
For sure it's not. We know that we have actually waiting lists for some of our programs. We know there are a lot more people out there that need services, and we would like to continue to grow our services, not just for the sake of growing, but we want to meet those needs. We know there's people out there that can really benefit from what we do, and we want to help them do that. Our problem is we don't have enough staff. As everybody knows, there's people, help wanted signs everywhere, and we are one of those people. And we try to make sure that the people that we're hiring are people that are caring people, that are going to have a relationship with the folks that we serve. So we won't hire just anybody, but that's our biggest stumbling block right now.
And I worry, though, because of that safety net, about those people that are on your waiting list. What happens? I mean, what are they missing out? What progression do they not get because there just simply isn't enough staffing?
Well, unfortunately, they don't have a lot of options. So what we see sometimes is if somebody hasn't gotten anything going at when they're in high school, or when they're ready to graduate, they will have a gap of services. So if they go from high school to adult services and there's nothing available for them in adult services, they might just sit at home for a while. And then they'll lose some of those skills that they gained while they were in school. So that's unfortunate. We also have kind of the other end of the spectrum where there's people that are much older, and maybe they have some medical issues that we could take care of in some of our programs, but they don't have anywhere else to go, so they end up like in a nursing home situation, which is completely inappropriate for most of the folks that we serve. So there aren't a lot of good options.
So your services really do deal with not only people giving them living skills, independent living skills, but also employment skills. Tell me about the first part, the living skills. I don't want to use the word integrating, but I will say that, is that making sure that these individuals are able to survive in today's society.
So we have a couple of different options for people that want to live in the community. So we have support in apartments or homes. So generally what happens is somebody will find a couple roommates. They'll want to move out of their family's home at some point, like we all do. They'll find a couple of roommates in an apartment or a condo or something like that. And then we'll provide whatever support that they need. So for a lot of people, that means there's always a staff person there. For other people, they don't need to be there all the time, but we help them with all the things that you need to live in an apartment. So cooking and cleaning and doing laundry and paying your rent and all the financial responsibilities, getting groceries, all those things, our staff are there to support them.
And that's why it's so, you know, staff important. That's why you need so many people.
Exactly. And then we also have another option for people that need a little bit more support, quite a bit more support actually. We have a residential center for people that require like nursing care and that just have a lot more challenges in their life. So that's another option for people as they age or if they just have that level of functioning.
And then the other critical aspect, of course, is for people of certain levels of functioning is to be able to find gainful employment.
Right. So I'll tell you a little story of somebody, and that'll kind of explain all of our employment services. We had a gentleman that was involved in a couple of our different programs, and sort of his life goal was to get a job and to earn a paycheck. Everybody wants to do that, right? And so he started out in our pre-vocational program, and what that meant is he learned how to get along with coworkers. He learned some job skills. He learned how to fill out an application, how to interview for a job, how to get back and forth to a job, all those things that you need to have a job. And then we had staff that helped him try to decide what he was interested in, what are kinds of jobs he was interested in. And then a job coach took him out and they helped him fill out applications, helped an interview for a job, and he now has a job. And he just is so proud of that because he's able to work in the community, he's able to earn that paycheck that he's wanted for so many years. And so he kind of went that continuum that we provide for employment services to help people like that.
Well, and as you said, you are somewhat picky about the employers that you do select. The employees tend to be very dependable and are very task-oriented, so able to do so many different jobs. What about the screening of employers?
Well, that's something that we work with as well. I mean, our staff are probably our biggest advocates because they will go to employers that maybe never had anybody with a disability in their place of employment before, and they can talk to them about, hey, this is what we have to offer. We have this great, willing, and eager workforce for you to try. And then they find that once a person is successful, they're much more willing to try another person, and it really works out great for both of us because they're filling slots that are difficult to fill and we're helping the individual that needs that job.
Well, and if an employer is interested, I mean, they would contact you, right?
Right. We love to go out and talk to people, but we also love to have people come and look at us and see what we have to offer. So yeah, just contact us.
We were also talking about the referral of services for people who can get help through Empowering Abilities. I got to double check the name. I always have to remember
I stumble on
to
it too
say
sometimes.
It absolutely correctly. I mean, for somebody who, and you said people can self refer themselves as well. Mm-hmm. How do you know that perhaps you do need your services?
Well, anybody that has a documented disability, mm-hmm. our focus is specifically on people with intellectual challenges or other developmental disabilities like autism or brain injuries, that kind of thing. And we serve only adults, so those would be the folks that we would take a look at, and then we would help them make sure that they have funding for their services and make sure that they are eligible and get all the documentation that's needed and all that sort of thing.
Because for parents, the children in the school system, there's that safety net, there's that help. But once the child does hit 18 or graduates from school, I mean, this fills a void that families years ago had couldn't turn to.
Right, and sometimes that transition is difficult because school is so much different than adults. We all know that when we turn to adults, like, oh my goodness, I have all these responsibilities
right
now. So, and it's maybe even more difficult for people that have additional challenges. So we like to have referrals early, even when somebody is not quite ready, just so we can work with the families and prepare them. We have some people that come to us just during the summertime to try to help with mm-hmm. that transition, and that's really helpful as well.
You do have a fundraiser I want to talk about, your 5K Spring Classic and Kid Run. It's coming up on Saturday, but this program may air after the run has already occurred. Brady Street Stadium starting at 8:30. It was interesting because it's not just one run. You've got a lot of different
yeah.
levels that you're going on that morning.
Right. We actually are just the recipients of the funds from this, which we think is a great role to play.
Yes.
And the race directors are actually taking the lead on it, and they have something for everyone. So it starts out with a kind of a traditional 5K. It'll start in Brady Street Stadium, go out into the community a little bit, and then end in Brady Street Stadium. And that's for adults, kids, they're saying dogs, probably not cats, but anybody really can, they want strollers, anybody can really participate in that, runners and walkers, whatever. So that's a great community event. And then right after that, they have a kids race. And then right after that is what they're calling the Victory Run, which is such a great idea and encompasses all the people that we serve. So anybody that has any kind of disability can participate in this. They'll run around the track. At the end, they'll get a goodie bag. The kids will also get a goodie bag. But it's a very fun, inclusive kind of thing where anybody with a disability can participate.
Isn't it also like so critically important as it also spreads the word
exactly.
and also gets out into the community?
Right, exactly. It's a great way to everybody can participate in something. They also have a corporate 4x4 challenge. And then they also at the very end have an invitational for some really good spirited runners. And they're also having at the end kind of a party type atmosphere with what they're calling the three B's. So it's beverages, bacon, and bagels.
All right.
That sounds great to me. So yeah, it's going to be a fun, fun event, and we're super excited to be a part of it.
Carol Foster, Chief Administration Officer of Empowering Abilities. Still ahead, sharing the importance of Wharton Fieldhouse in so many people's lives. But first, Rebecca Cassad and Alan Morrison are a true team. Rebecca plays ukulele, sings, and writes original songs. Alan accompanies her on the U-bass, acoustic guitar, and harmonizes. They joined us at the Black Box Theater to play one of their originals, Every Day of the Year. Rebecca Cassad and Alan Morrison with Every Day of the Year. In 1928, Calvin Coolidge was still in the White House. Moline's population was about a half of what it is today, and Whitey's ice cream? It wouldn't be invented for another 5 years. 1928 is the year Wharton Fieldhouse opened, a huge community effort to build a building that's still beloved today. On Friday, April 26th, WQPT will air its newest documentary telling the story of Wharton Fieldhouse. It's been a true community production. Matt Sawyer, WQPT's Director of Production, sat down with me to tell me some of those stories. So why was Wharton Fieldhouse picked as a topic? And you know, it's such a beloved building, especially in Moline.
Yeah, so I started here in August, and pretty much upon arrival, our Assistant Director of Development, Amanda Bergeson, mentioned it. And at the time, I was still learning the area, still learning about Wharton.
Right.
I hadn't really have enough of an understanding to really know what kind of project this would be. She kept at it and mentioned it again, and thankfully she did, because it is proving to be just the perfect project, and we decided to greenlight it. But yeah, Amanda Bergeson was born and raised in Moline, has like a long-standing, you know, history and sort of experiences with Wharton, so I think it's a bit of a passion project for her.
Well, you go back to, like, the building was built in 28.
Mm-hmm.
It was home of the Tri-City Blackhawks,
yep.
You know, which are now the Atlanta Hawks,
yeah.
You know? And as a person who wasn't from here, you didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
And then you think of the concerts that went on there, and
right.
I think of All-Star Wrestling that was going on there. And of course, you know, the Maroons basketball team, and so many athletic events have been there. It was kind of eye-opening for you, but in a way, for this documentary, you hope it to be somewhat eye-opening for people who know the building well.
Absolutely. I think that has been one of the most enjoyable and surprising aspects of this process thus far, is just you know, not only all the people from, you know, Barry Goldwater to JFK to Nixon to Johnny Cash to, you know, Hulk Hogan or, you know.
I didn't know Jack Benny.
Yeah.
I think that's cool too.
Yeah. So you have this, you know, historical, like, legacy of just phenomenal performances, professional sports, and you know, and high school athletics. But then it's also this other side of it that's this really beautiful sort of institution of community gathering and community support that really has been, for me, one of the most interesting and you know, surprising and you know, satisfying aspects of this process is just seeing how much Wharton means to not only, you know, people from Moline, but you could say the Quad Cities.
I thought it was interesting also because a story like this can't be told without hearing from the people of the community.
For sure.
And you really did reach out. What did you get back? I mean, were you surprised at the response?
Yes, I think we were. I mean, I think we kind of knew we were going to get a lot of different stories, right? Because there's a lot of diverse people out there. And so, but yeah, it's been really cool to hear what people have to share. And you know, one of the stories is, I forget the name of the person, but the granddaughter of the person who made the first basket at Wharton.
So that opened the Moline-Kiwani game?
Yep, correct.
Back in 1928?
Yep. Yeah, December 21st, 1928, which was, you know, interestingly followed up by the University of Iowa and Marquette University basketball game right after it. And then somebody has still one of the bonds that were issued. So, yeah, like, just for context, Wharton was funded off of bonds. You know, the community threw money down, bought bonds, and raised initially $150,000 for construction, which is mind-boggling in itself, done in 6 months. And then I think it was like another $25,000 they added to it for the roof to make the roof more of a, I think they're like buttressed is what they say, but mm-hmm. It's basically just more of an open space. And I think the total cost of construction was $175,000.
And if you think about it, 1928, if it would have been just a few years later, you know, the Depression, it wouldn't have been done.
Right.
You've been in the building now quite a bit.
Yeah.
What do you like about Wharton?
You know, we've interviewed a few different people, and it's been interesting to hear people talk about how they can feel the history in the place. And I think it's, you know, it's true. You go in there and you just feel how important this place is and all of the sort of legacy that comes from it. But I think architecturally, it's a really beautiful building as well. I mean, from the outside, they've done a really good job of preserving it. And then inside, it still has that sort of, you know, working class, like, you know.
I always think of the movie Hoosiers with the Indiana high school basketball gymnasiums.
Right.
I mean, I just, for some unknown reason, I always kind of have that feeling. Because
it
is a callback to times gone. On the other hand, the renovations has made it still a vital building today.
Yeah, I mean, interesting fact is city developers and the architect William Schulsky went to Indiana early on and looked at some of those field houses to get ideas for what they wanted to do and how they wanted to do it. So, yeah, a lot of those Indiana basketball field houses were very much inspiration for Wharton.
Is it, I'm going to say is it important, but of course it is. I mean, was it difficult to get it right? I mean, to tell this story in a way that you think is appropriate, and how do you think you were able to do that?
I mean, we're still doing it, you know? to try to answer your question is to say, I think when you take on a project like this, you have to be, this is more for the community. It's about trying to share in that legacy, that history. And I think that's been our grounding mantra or, you know, ethic, if you will, to hold us kind of as close as we can be to why we're making this project and why we wanted to make this project. So it's, you know, we don't want to make it about us. It's about the community. And I think that as long as we try our best to hold that up and put that at the front, you know, that the stories will tell themselves. And, you know, in 4 years, it'll be 100 years old, right? So the story is still going, right? It's not a done story.
I really wanted to underline that too. Yeah, because, I mean, you're talking about a historic building, but it's still very vibrant.
Right, right. I mean, last year, first time in Moline boys basketball history, they win state, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and just how much that means to the people in the area. So, yeah, it's a really important and, you know, historically, like, significant building that has had amazing, you know, performances and events in it. But simultaneously, it is a place that brings people together and unites community. And consequently, we felt like it's important to try and highlight that story.
You did mention the person who had found the one of the original bonds yeah. from way back when. Right. I mean, was there any other stories that surprised you, or any theme that other than pride and I mean, here's the thing that I know about Wharton is that when the Thunder played there,
yeah.
That place was loud,
mm.
And the stands were packed. And there was always a discussion that when, and it was, I believe it was in, when the Mark or the Vibrant Arena or whatever you want to, iWireless Center or whatever you want to call it these days, when it was constructed, the Thunder moved there in 93, their attendance went down. The you couldn't pack it the same way. I mean, is that the story that you hear over and over again? Is just the fact that Wharton has a certain vibe when there's something going on inside it?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And yeah, we talked to someone who saw the Birds there in like the 60s.
Yeah, there's a couple years ago. Yeah.
And they were just like, I was like, oh, what was that like? And they're like, they said something to the point of, it's a terrible place to see a show because there's so much, like, it gets so loud and there's a lot of echoes. But, you know, up until the 90s, I think one of the last musical acts to perform there was Jazzy Jeff and Will Smith, I believe. So, yeah, there's been a really interesting sort of patchwork of a lot of eclectic and like, you know, varying degrees of performances. But one theme that stuck out was just how many people went and saw all-star wrestling matches at Wharton, and how much, people from the community just love that. And that, I thought that was a cool, someone sent us some pictures and they're really quite amazing. It's got like Hacksaw Jim Duggan in there and like The Undertaker. So, yeah, it's cool.
Our thanks to Matt Stoller, WQPT's Director of Productions. And once again, WQPT will air this newest documentary telling the story of Wharton Fieldhouse. It's coming up Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m. On the air, on the radio, on the web, on your mobile device, and streaming on your computer. Thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.
Presley and Van Ho Funeral Homes have been serving Quad City families and veterans for over 100 years. Whelan Presley is located in Rock Island, Milan, Reynolds, and Van Ho in East Moline, proudly supporting WQPT.